Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1363. What really happened at Pearl Harbor, part two. This is being recorded on December 7th of the year 2024. Well, this is obviously the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Before we get into a continuation of the discussion, please get the flash drive, the 64 gigabyte flash drive of all of my life's work. These two shows will be on it. The conversations with Monty, everything I've done, I'm on my 46th year on the air, all the comments by the brilliant Parafractal, and also a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy to download PDF files. I get no money whatsoever from this, and this is my entire life's work. Now, to the subject at hand, because the attack on Pearl Harbor has been blamed falsely on negligence by Franklin Roosevelt, or deliberately conspiratorial aspects or behavior by Roosevelt to get the U.S. into World War II. And because now that fantasy, that disinformation is being used to discredit the New Deal as the Republicans are getting ready to attack Social Security and Medicare, I think it is timely that we hear more about this. Now, I've been relying on, to a large extent, on the book Pearl Harbor Final Judgment by Henry C. Clausen and Bruce Lee. We're going to continue with this. And Henry C. Clausen, again, Major Clausen, I believe he was then promoted to colonel. But he was specifically appointed by then Secretary of War Henry Stimson to investigate Pearl Harbor, and as we have seen, not only did he have a very secure office with a safe-like lock on it, but he also carried all of the secret B-clips in a bomb pouch, basically equipped with a magnesium bomb that would incinerate them and him if he could have been captured. So we in the interest of time, we're going to continue with what we spoke about. By the way, there was it's obvious that they knew what was going to be coming at Pearl Harbor. We look at the alert that was given on January 24th of 1941. We looked at the warning that Kimmel and Short got on November 27th of 1941. We talked about the carriers. I'm going to jump right in, and I'm going to repeat, because this is absolutely critical. Now, again, the U.S. had broken the Japanese Purple Code. That was a diplomatic code. And when you hear, for example, Washington, London, etc., they're talking about the Japanese embassies there, not, you know, Washington, you know, London, etc., etc. The U.S. had broken the Japanese Purple Code, and the message was given to Admiral Kimmel on December 5th of 1941, and some of it earlier, and it was translated in Washington. But by December 5th, Admiral Husband Kimmel, who also informed Short, knew that the Japanese were about to attack in days, if not hours. And yet, as we shall see, when a Japanese midget submarine attempted to enter Pearl Harbor, it was spotted both by a patrol aircraft, a patrol aircraft, and then by the destroyer USS Ward, which sank the submarine and alerted Admiral Kimmel. He should have sounded General Quarters, as was directed in the Rainbow Five mobilization plan for World War II that was leaked to the press by Admiral Kobe Wiedemeyer. But again, this is really fundamental here. And again, Admiral Clausen, there is no source better than, Major Clausen is the ultimate source here. The third message was sent in the Purple Code from Tokyo to the embassy, to Washington on December 1st, but was not translated in Washington until December 5th. This message told Washington to, quote, discontinue the use of your code machine purple and dispose of it immediately, unquote. Special emphasis was given to taking the machine apart and breaking up its important parts. Washington also ordered to burn its machine codes. The fourth message advised the diplomats that if they had to destroy their codes, they should contact the naval attaché in that particular embassy and use the special chemicals the attaché possessed to ensure that vital documents and equipment were properly destroyed. This message was sent by Tokyo on December 1st in the Purple Code and translated in Washington the same day. The fifth message was also sent in the Purple Code from Tokyo to Washington on December 2nd, translated on December 3rd, corrected on December 4th. It gave specific instructions to the Japanese diplomats in Washington to burn all their Purple Codes, plus all the other codes the embassy possessed. Only one copy each of two special codes were to be retained for future use. Washington was also told that it was to, quote, stop using at once one Purple Code machine unit and destroy it completely, unquote, emphasis added. Meanwhile, a cipher specialist named Kosaka, K-O-S-A-K-A, should have been returned to Tokyo on a Japanese ship that left the United States on November 28th. The last three messages were of extreme significance. When a nation prepares to launch an attack and go to war, one of the most indispensable steps it takes is to make sure that its codes and code machines cannot be captured by the enemy should the enemy retaliate and raid an embassy for intelligence reasons. Washington knew from reading those messages that war would have to break out with Japan attacking somewhere in the Pacific. By the way, parenthetically, U.S. naval intelligence had noticed, and this has been misrepresented, shall we say, very, very terrible, but the Japanese carriers had basically assumed radio silence. And also it was noted that the Japanese naval attaché in various embassies connected with the British Empire had been very curious about the British naval attack on Toronto. By the way, not Toronto, Canada, T-A-R-A-N-T-O, a key Italian port in the Mediterranean, where very important Italian ships were attacked by the British Swordfish aircraft that were flown from British carriers. Britain and Japan had particularly close relations prior to World War II. The Japanese, to make a very long story very, very short, looked to Britain, an island nation like Japan, which had used sea power to build a powerful empire, and the Japanese basically sought to do the same thing. So there were close relations between Japan and Germany, between Japan and Britain, and it was noticed that Japanese naval attachés were very curious about the nature of the British attack on Toronto. These things taken together helped to alert the U.S. about what was coming. But continuing here, repeating the last, some of this passage. The last three messages were of extreme significance. When the nation prepares to launch an attack and go to war, one of the most indispensable steps it takes is to make sure that its codes and code machines cannot be captured by the enemy should the enemy retaliate and raid an embassy for intelligence reasons. Washington knew from reading these messages that war would have to break out with Japan attacking somewhere in the Pacific. Therefore, the Navy in Washington alerted Kimmel. One more time. Therefore, the Navy in Washington alerted Kimmel on December 3rd, 4 days before the attack, by sending two advisory messages that paraphrased the intercepts I have described above. The first message read as follows. Highly reliable information has been received that categoric and urgent instructions were sent yesterday to Japanese diplomatic and consular posts at Hong Kong, Singapore, Batavia, Manila, Washington, and London to destroy most of their codes and ciphers at once and to burn all other important confidential and secret documents. The second message to Kimmel read, quote, Circular 2444 from Tokyo, 1 December, ordered London, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Manila to destroy machine. Batavia machine already sent Tokyo. December 2nd, Washington also directed destroy all but one copy of other systems and all secret documents British Admiralty, London, Today Reports, Embassy, London, has completed. Again, we're repeating what Henry Clausen has written here. Therefore, the Navy in Washington alerted Kimmel on December 3rd, December 3rd by sending two advisory messages that paraphrase the intercepts I have described below. Okay, I've quoted that now. Continuing. Because the Navy paraphrased these warning messages to Kimmel, they differ somewhat from the messages that I carried in my bomb pouch, which I showed to Commander Rochefort. Both the Navy warning messages to Kimmel are exceedingly important, but the second is the more important. The first implies that Tokyo has ordered its embassies and consulates around the world to burn their codes, but it is the second that says without equivocation that Tokyo has ordered its consulates to destroy their codes and code machines. Once code machines were destroyed, there could be no turning back potential Japanese attacks. The consulates could no longer communicate effectively with Tokyo. War had to follow. It was inevitable. This meant that, apparently, Commander Rochefort had seen vital intelligence warnings to Kimmel, indicating that Japan was preparing to attack within a matter of days or hours. One more time. It meant that Rochefort had seen vital intelligence warnings to Kimmel, that's Admiral Husband Kimmel, indicating that Japan was preparing to attack within a matter of days or hours. And again, therefore, the Navy in Washington alerted Kimmel on December 3rd by sending two advisory messages that paraphrased the intercepts I described above. Again, Kimmel was notified, but there was, some of it was given on the 5th, but on December 3rd, 4 days before the attack. Now, I've spoke earlier of Homer Ferguson of Michigan, and he was a Rockwood Republican who was basically trying to pin the whole thing on Franklin Roosevelt. And Henry Clausen in public hearings basically made a fool of Homer Ferguson. Well, actually, I'd better say that Homer Ferguson made a fool of himself. But Henry Clausen put Ferguson's B blank 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 in the dirt. Talking about the public hearings here. I then turned the tables on Ferguson. If he could try to use Bratton against me, I could really use Bratton against Ferguson. I said, quote, Senator, Colonel Bratton and Henry Clausen agree that the most important information that came into the War Department was information that the Jap councils, Senator, Colonel Bratton and Henry Clausen agree that the most important information that came into the War Department was information that the Jap consuls and their diplomatic representatives were burning their codes. That spells war in any man's language, and we do not need that long, self-serving, hocus-pocus 14-part message to know it, unquote. Ferguson made a sarcastic comment about my being one of those officers who believed war was imminent when Washington learned the Japanese were burning their codes, and, quote, war in effect would be on in any moment, unquote. Yes, sir, it was imminent, unquote, I said. Ferguson fell into the trap. All right, unquote, he said, began quoting. Now, did you try to find out why an alert was not sent out on those codes, unquote? I hadn't. Suddenly, I knew that Ferguson hadn't read my report. I carefully replied that an alert had been sent by Bratton to Colonel Fielder, who said he had never received it, although Colonel Bicknell had seen it on Fielder's desk and taken action on it himself. This was the famous missing cable number 519. Ferguson knew he couldn't close the lid on this Pandora's box he had opened, so he plowed through the issue and learned about the two warning messages of December 3rd that had been in the Navy's hands at Pearl Harbor on Commander Rochefort's desk, to be exact, which was where Ferguson wished the hearings hadn't gone. Excuse me. I'm chuckling here. In this manner, I was able to introduce the conflicting testimony given to me by Rochefort and Fielder. That set Ferguson back a step or two. Still, he plunged on. We discussed the two warning messages about the destruction of the Japanese codes that Washington had sent to Hawaii, and I asked, quote, did not one of these refer, Senator, to the destruction by the Japanese embassy in Washington of the purple machine, unquote? Not that I know of, unquote, replied Ferguson, again quoting, I do not think the words purple machine, unquote, were mentioned in any way that I have seen, unquote. And Clausen replies, quote, you see, purple machine means an awful lot, I said. I appreciate that, said Ferguson. If these messages had said destroy the purple machine, That is a different message. After I got counsel to give the committee's copy of my, one more time. After I got counsel to give me the committee's copy of my report, I looked up the appropriate page. Quote, Senator, as I understand that the purple machine was ordered destroyed, I said, again quoting, I am reading here from the affidavit of Captain Thomas A. Huckins, H-U-C-K-I-N-S, which I took at Pearl Harbor. He is in the Navy, and I wanted to see just what dispatches they had gotten from Washington, unquote. And quote, but that was never sent to Kimmel and Short, was it, unquote, Ferguson said. Quote, it certainly was, I replied. I had him stone cold dead. I walked Ferguson through the evidence proving that Hawaii had been warned by the British Secret Intelligence Service on December 3rd that war was going to break out between Japan, Britain, and America, but not Russia. I also explained that on December 3rd, the Navy Department had warned Kimmel that the Japanese had ordered their embassy in Washington to destroy its purple machines and its codes with the exception of one system. Furthermore, Tokyo had sent the same order to London, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Manila. Washington had advised Kimmel about that, too. As I continued my presentation, I could sense a feeling of electricity going around the room. For the first time, the committee had a witness who could pinpoint exactly when warnings had been sent to Pearl Harbor, prove they were adequate, and show that Kimmel and Short had failed to heed them. And, you know, I've taken a lot of fresh fertilizer over the decades I've been doing this from people saying, well, Dave, I mean, papers, read books, but you can actually learn an awful lot from reading. And one of the things that Henry Clausen points out in the book here is the inexcusable failure to act by both Admiral Kimmel and General Short is that much more inexcusable because the newspapers were reporting an awful lot of what was going on, continuing with Pearl Harbor Final Judgment. The last stops I made before returning to Washington were the offices of the Honolulu Advertiser and the Honolulu Star Bulletin. I'd gone to them earlier to read through their clip files when I said earlier that I thought General Short might have learned more from the local papers than he might have learned from Colonel Fielder. I wasn't being facetious. I had counted 32 major stories in both papers that had run between November 7th and December 6th, 1941, and were remarkably accurate as to the state of the Japanese-American diplomacy and Japanese aggression in the Far East. A majority of these stories appeared in the crucial days between November 27th, again, that's when the war warning went out to Hawaii and the whole Pacific Command, and December 6th, Wilmington. A majority of these stories appeared in the crucial days between November 27th and December 6th, and they earned headlines such as these. U.S.-Japan talks broken off as Ho rejects appeasement. Full surrender demanded in U.S. statement, November 27th. Evacuation speeded as peace fades, November 27th. U.S. rejects compromise in Far East. Washington insists on maintenance of status quo. Withdrawal from China by Japan Army, November 29th. KURSU, K-U-R-U-S-O, K-U-R-S-U, excuse me. Bluntly warned nation ready for battle. Foreign affairs experts attack. One more time. KURSU bluntly warned nation ready for a battle. Foreign affairs experts attack Tokyo madness, November 30th. Leaders call back troops in Singapore. Hope wanes as negotiations fail at parleys. Hawaii troops delivered, November 30th. One more time. Leaders call back troops in Singapore. Hope wanes as nations fail at parleys. Hawaii troops delivered, November 30th. U.S. Army arriving in Manila, Singapore mobilizing as war tension grows, December 1st. Japan gives 2 weeks more to negotiations, prepares for action in event of failure, December 2nd. U.S. demands explanation of Japan moves. Americans prepare for any emergency. Navy declared ready, December 3rd. Japanese pin blame on U.S. Japanese Army paper charges violations by FDR, December 4th. Pacific Zero Hour Mirror. Japan answers U.S. today, December 5th. America expected to reject Japan's reply on Indochina. Ho may ask proof, suggest troops recall. December 6th. And Clausen goes on to comment, this was but a sampling of the news reports available in Pearl Harbor before the Japanese attack. I took them back to Washington, where I discussed them with Bundy and Secretary Stinson in conjunction with General Short's argument before the Army Board that he hadn't been kept fully informed by Washington of the breakdown of Japanese-American relations, and that the War Department's warning message of November 27th was too ambiguous to allow him to act properly. Stinson was incensed. The Hawaiian papers had been remarkably accurate in their reporting. This led me to draft the following language for Stinson's final statement that was presented during the ultimate congressional investigation on Pearl Harbor. Quote, even without any such message, the War Department dispatched on November 27th, which parenthetically I have read twice, the outpost commander should have been on the alert. If he did not know that the relations between Japan and the U.S. were strained and might be broken at any time, he must have been the only man in Hawaii who did not know it, for the radio and newspapers were blazoning these facts daily, and he had a chief of staff and an intelligence officer to tell him so. And if he did not know the Japanese were likely to strike without warning, he could have read his history of Japan or known the lessons taught in the Army schools in respect to such matters, such as their supplies attack on Port Arthur in the Russo-Japanese War. But again, this is from the newspapers that were available. Now, of the contention that Franklin Roosevelt deliberately allowed the attack that was perceived, blah, 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 and we've already seen what basically was a verbiage. Kimmel and Short were alerted of, and Clausen writes again, we then tackled the question of the 13-part Japanese intercept of the evening of December 6th. Miles acknowledged that he was aware of this intercept, quote, because I was landing at the home of my opposite number in the Navy, Admiral Wilkinson. Quote, the 13-part decrypt was carried to Wilkinson's home by Admiral Beardall, B-E-A-R-B-A-L-L, the president's aide. Wilkinson had read the 13-part message, then handed it to Miles. Now I had confirmation that the heads of intelligence for both the Army and the Navy had read the all-important 13-part decrypt on the evening of December 6th. Again, Admiral Kimmel was awarded on December 3rd. Continuing. Yet neither of them had seen anything as sinister in the message as had the President, who said it meant war. Now, another piece of that disinformation that we read about in part one was that once the British knew that the attack was coming and let it go because they didn't over to America because they wanted in the war, blah, 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 blah. Now, again, the British decoding operation at Bletchley Park had, they had, in their ultra operation, they had broken the German Enigma code. And those decrypts, along with decrypts of the Japanese Purple Code, were included with the magic intercepts that were provided to the commanders of Hawaii at Pearl Harbor and the related installations. But again, the Navy one day, the Army one day, but still, they were alerted. But here, Major Clausen, Major Colonel Clausen, I believe, visited Bletchley Park, where those decrypts were being made, and he discusses this as follows. I visited Bletchley Park and reviewed the British decrypts of the Japanese Purple Codes. Copies of these decrypts are included in the appendix of this book as exhibit number 8 on pages 353 to 393. They prove two things. One is that the British intercepted approximately the same messages as did the Americans before Pearl Harbor. The second is that the British appear to have shared this information with the United States, which meant that it is highly doubtful that the British conspired to allow the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. It is also important to remember that despite Friedman's having solved the huge, he helped to break the Japanese code, by the way. It is also important to remember that despite Friedman's having solved the secret of breaking the Japanese diplomatic code, we never broke all the purple messages we intercepted, and the more important Japanese naval codes were almost never broken. That refers to the white code. But again, the notion that the British deliberately allowed the attack to go on. The second one is that the British intercepted possibly the same messages as did the Americans before Pearl Harbor. The second is that the British appear to have shared this information with the U.S., which means that it is highly doubtful that the British conspired to allow the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. And again, Clausen had visited Bletchley Park. On a personal note, I want to note that one of the officers at Bletchley Park who was involved with the decryption was a guy named Colonel Harry Beckhoff, B-E-C-K-H-O-U-G-H. And I am honored to say that Harry Beckhoff also took note of my website and work and contributed some information about from the books he had written about Germany. And a comment that I made to Colonel Beckhoff, he was about 98 at this point, and this was about 2012. He passed away 3 years later. At Colonel Beckhoff, once again, it is deeply gratifying to see one of the heroes of Bletchley Park using this website and continuing the struggle against fascism. In a supplemental comment, perhaps you could provide interested readers or listeners with information about ordering your books. In addition, I too have been warning about this and predicting that the seeds sown in the latter stages of the war, that's World War II, and during the post-war period would blossom anew. Those seeds are now sprouting. We must all be constant gardeners, unquote, pulling the weeds wherever we find them. Best, Dave Emery. And Colonel Beckhoff replied, all detailed in my books, Germany's Four Reichs, 2002-2003, and sequel, and title of his second book. This is in 2012, and Colonel Beckhoff passed away 3 years later, and in an article about him, talking about how remarkably was this from A Personal Appreciation of the Life of Harry Beckhoff, How I Will Remember Probably the Most Remarkable Man I Have Ever Met, by Nigel Curtin, K-E-R-P-O-N, from the Marlborough News in Great Britain, from March 17th to 2015. Skipping down. This cheery centenarian could well have written his own epitaph in the title of his autobiography, Thinker, Paper, Soldier, Spy. It's a play on a title of a spy novel, but Thinker, not Pinker. Thinker, Paper, Soldier, Spy. A play on the words of the children's pudding game with cherry or prune stones. He was a thinker, a lifelong philosopher, a paper who started his own clothing companies, including the famous Double Two shirt brand, a soldier who fought through World War II with the 8th Army, achieving the rank of colonel, and a spy because he was invited to join Britain's code-breaking team at Bletchley Park, whose work in breaking enemy codes was credited with ending the 1939-1945 war years earlier than it might have dragged on. Well, again, he passed away in 2015, so I just want to give a posthumous salute to Colonel Beckhoff and say that some of us very much honor the work he did at Bletchley Park, and some of us have continued the struggle against fascism, but sadly not enough. Now, again, on January 24th of 1941, the War Department warned the relevant personnel at Pearl Harbor of the following, and I'm going to reread this in part one of this program. I'm going to reread it. The primary duty of Short and Kimmel was to protect the fleet. This was made clear by the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, who wrote a letter to his counterpart, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, on January 24, 1941, which said, if war eventuates with Japan, it is believed easily possible that hostilities would be initiated by a surprise attack upon the fleet or the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The dangers envisaged in order of their importance and probability are considered to be 1, air bombing attack, check, that happened, 2, air torpedo plane attack, check, that happened, 3, sabotage, that did not happen, 4, submarine attack, that happened too. Now again, on November 27th, of 1941, the Admiral Kimmel and General Short were alerted that war was coming, and that General Marshall wrote to them, and I've read this at the end of our previous, actually I read this in part one, and I think repeated it in part two. One more time, part of that message is said, prior to the hostile Japanese action, you are directed to undertake such reconnaissance and other measures as you deem necessary, but these measures should be carried out so as not to alarm civilian population or disclose intent. Report measures taken should hostilities occur. You will carry out the task assigned in Rainbow 5 so far as they pertain to Japan. Continuing. This policy, repeating something that's above, this policy should not be construed as restricting you to a course of action that might jeopardize your defense. And that is worth noting, and so should the following. Now, back to what took place on December 7th, 1941. And you can even see some of this in the commercial movie Tora, Tora, Tora. But reading from Wikipedia. Now, summing up what was going on here. On December 7th, 1941, the supply ship USS Antares, A-N-T-A-R-E-S, was entering Pearl Harbor, and it was spotted both by the Japanese. Japanese had packed Pearl Harbor not just with aircraft, but a number of Japanese submarines outside of the Hawaiian Islands had basically carried two-man midget submarines, which were then dispatched to join the attack on Pearl Harbor. One of those submarines, it was spotted following the USS Antares, and after the submarine screen at Pearl Harbor was to be dropped, it was hoping to infiltrate Pearl Harbor and commence with an attack. It was spotted. Now, reading from Wikipedia about the USS Antares. On December 7th, 1941, Antares stood toward the entrance of Pearl Harbor at 6:30 with a 500-long-ton steel barge in tow, having arrived from Canton and Palmyra, and expecting to transfer the barge to a tug and then proceed into Pearl. Not sighting the tug at the appointed time, Antares altered course, turning slowly to the east, when her watch suddenly spotted a suspicious object about 1,500 yards on the auxiliary's starboard quarter. Antares notified the destroyer Ward on patrol off the harbor entrance, and the latter altered course toward the object, which proved to be a midget submarine. A PBY Catalina from Patrol Squadron 14 showed up almost simultaneously and dropped smoke floats in the vicinity. Meanwhile, Ward went to general quarters and attacked, sinking the intruder. And he notified, the commander of the USS Ward notified Admiral Kimmel. Now, from the Wikipedia entry on the USS Ward. On the morning of December 7th, 1941, under the command of Lieutenant Commander William W. Outerbridge, O-U-T-E-R-B-R-I-D-G-E, Ward was conducting a precautionary patrol off the entrance to Pearl Harbor when she was informed at 3:57 by visual signals from the coastal minesweeper Condor of a periscope sighting, whereupon Ward began searching for the contact. At about 6:37, she sighted a periscope apparently tailing the cargo ship Antares, whereupon she attacked the target. Though unconfirmed at the time, her guns hold a Japanese Ko Hayotake class two-man midget submarine. The death of its two-man crew was the first American cause casualties in the Pacific theater of World War II, occurring a few hours before Japanese carrier aircraft attacked Pearl Harbor. Again, the death of its two-man crew was the first American-caused casualties in the Pacific theater of World War II, occurring a few hours before Japanese carrier aircraft attacked Pearl Harbor. The submarine was attempting to enter the harbor by following Antares through the anti-submarine nets at the harbor entrance. By entering territorial waters of a neutral country without signaling any intent to stop, the submarine was not entitled to, quote, innocent passage, unquote, protections, and the neutral party had a right to use whatever means to protect its territory. Ward fired several rounds from its main guns, hitting the conning tower of the submarine, and also dropped several depth charges during the attack. Now again, the USS Ward spotted a midget submarine, and the command at Pearl Harbor was warned by the War Department on January 24th, 1941. By the way, it was in that same month that Wake Island was getting built up. They commenced building a military base on Wake Island, and the USS Enterprise was ferrying aircraft to Wake Island because there had been a war warning started that had been sent out on November 27th of 1941. When Admiral Husband Kimmel was notified by the USS Ward that it had, in all probability, attacked a Japanese submarine attempting to inboard an enemy submarine, Japanese submarine, attempting to infiltrate Pearl Harbor, and Kimmel was notified. He did not notify Pearl Harbor to sound general quarters, as he was advised to do in the Rainbow Five plan. He basically said, you know, quote, he asked for confirmation. That was a huge dereliction duty. Again, on December 3rd, Kimmel had been alerted to what was about to take place. And when that Japanese submarine was engaged by and sunk by the USS Ward, and note that on January 24th, 1941, Kimmel and others were warned of a Japanese submarine attack on Pearl Harbor, he should have had Pearl Harbor, and also he notified General. They should have basically everything. Pearl Harbor should have been put on general quarters, and instead of having the attack proceed unopposed, the people, basically the Japanese air armada, would have faced vigorous anti-aircraft fire, and certainly that would not have precluded the attack, but it would not have been as effective. Would have inflicted more losses on the Japanese air armada, particularly if there had been aircraft scrambled at that point in time. Also, General Short allowed the Army aircraft at various fields to be parked wingtip to wingtip. The same was true of Navy aircraft. That would have made them more vulnerable to sabotage. Also made the air attack on those aircraft more effective. That was what Admiral Kimmel did not pay attention to. The USS Ward engaged a midget submarine at 6:30 that morning, warned him about what was going to take place, and he did nothing. And that is just absolutely spectacular. And more about what took place and the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. Now, there are many, many, you know, again, could have, would have, should have, moving, and once again, part of the whole, you know, well, Roosevelt allowed this, the deliberate propaganda, blah, 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 blah. Was it, well, how about the carriers? Well, again, the USS Enterprise, pursuant to the war warning on November 27, 1941, was ferrying aircraft to Wake Island, the military buildup of which began in that same month. The USS Lexington was out of harbor because it was ferrying aircraft to Midway Island, pursuant to the war warning on November 27th of 1941. And the USS Saratoga was in San Diego for routine repairs. That's why the bleeping carriers were not in harbor. And again, the battleships, which were all old and fell before, were built before the Washington Naval Treaty of 1942, and the aircraft carriers, which were built up on the Lexington and Saratoga, were converted battle cruisers. That is an old weapon system. The idea behind the battlecruiser was to use the heavy gun firepower of battleships, dreadnought battleships, and yet they were more lightly armored to make them faster. That was the concept. The aircraft carriers have a speed of roughly 35 knots per hour, and the battleships, roughly 22, 23 knots per hour. It would have slowed the carriers down, made them easier to detect. Had the carriers been sorted with the battleships, again, this is all pure fantasy. But what is really interesting to me is what happened to the Admiral Yamamoto was eventually shot down. The intercepts located where he was going to be flying to, and U.S. aircraft intercepted his plane. He was shot down and killed. But the general who commanded the air armada at Pearl Harbor, and who designed much of the attack, was General Minoru Genda, G-E-N-D-A. His nickname was the Madman. Among the things he did, and again, I'm having to telescope a lot of this through the dictates of time, Pearl Harbor was very shallow. That's what permitted many of the battleships to be eventually fully repaired and more heavily armed. They had updated anti-aircraft weaponry and fire control systems on their 14-inch guns, which made them radar fire control systems on their 14-inch guns, which made them much more effective. But what one of the things that was presumed was that Pearl Harbor might be immune to naval torpedo attack because of the shallow depth of the harbor. What Minoru Genda did is he took those naval torpedoes, the ones that were going to be dropped by planes, and put fins on them so they wouldn't run as deep, though they were very effective. He also, among the attacking aircraft at Pearl Harbor were horizontal bombers. I believe the horizontal bombers, and one of the weapons that they, munitions that they carried were converted 16-inch shells from Nagato-class battleships. And what I'm about to talk about, again, spoiler alert, this is a, quote, conspiracy theory, there used to be, maybe there still is, a plaque on the USS Arizona, which was destroyed at Pearl Harbor and remains on the bottom of the harbor to this day. It's a memorial. Still leaking oil, by the way, into the harbor. But it has been generally presumed that a Japanese bomb went right down the smokestack of the USS Arizona. That is not true. What happened was that one of those converted 16-inch shells, again, very, very heavily designed to penetrate armor. One of those 16-inch shells from a Nagato-class battleship that was specially repurposed by General Genda into bombs hit the USS Arizona's deck, went right through and detonated the magazines and everything, and that was the end of the Arizona and a lot of the people on it. I do not know why the disinformation, maybe it's been corrected, takes place, but why they have that plaque saying, well, they used to anyway, I don't know if it's still there, saying that the Arizona was, basically a bomb went right down its smokestack. That is not true. One of the things that's interesting is what happened with General Minoru Genda. From his Wikipedia entry, he is best known for helping to plan the attack on Pearl Harbor. After the war, he became the third chief of staff of the Japan Air Self-Defense Force. And by talking about what he felt would be needed for this, skipping down, Genda felt that the task was, quote, difficult but not impossible, unquote, and began working on the details of the plan. Genda favored a three-wave attack using six aircraft carriers for a successful airstrike. Genda was responsible for much of the training, especially in the new tactics of shallow water torpedo use, effective use of level bombing by tactical aircraft. Again, some of them were dropping converted 16-inch shells from Nagato-class battleships and coordinating several aircraft carriers simultaneously. He played a role in persuading IJN leaders to name Mitsuo Fushida, his classmate at the Japanese Naval Academy, as the leader of the air attack itself. Skip me down. After the establishment of the Japan Self-Defense Forces in 1954, Genda was commissioned into the Japan Air Self-Defense Force as a major general. He served as its chief of staff from 1959 to 1962. As commander of the Air Self-Defense Force, Genda successfully pushed for the acquisition of the Lockheed F-104 Starfighter, of which Japan bought 230. This became part of the Lockheed bribery scandals as evidence emerged that Lockheed had paid him a bribe. Genda visited Lockheed's headquarters in California, by the way, it's right in Sunnyvale, and at his own request personally flew a Starfighter. He was awarded the Legion of Merit by the United States Air Force a few months later. That is just surreal. but now fleshing out what Magenda did. After retiring from the military in 1962, he ran for and was elected to the upper house of Japan's legislature, the House of Councilors, as a member of the Seito faction within the Liberal Democratic Party. A very, very long story. I mean, very, very short. The Liberal Democratic Party was the financial godchild of Kodama Yoshio, who was both an admiral and a general, had a personal fortune of $13 billion at the end of World War II. That's $13 billion in World War II dollars, and became one of the top CIA people in Japan, according to many observers, the top one. And he basically helped to create and finance the Liberal Democratic Party, which became a vehicle for many of the same political and military figures who have been involved with Japan's war of aggression. We've spoken about that at great length in the past. Continuing with the Wikipedia entry. He was the first of several former SBF officers who entered politics under the auspices of the Seito faction, mostly at the far-right end of the Japanese political spectrum. He remained influential in politics for more than 20 years as a leading member of the Defense Division of the Liberal Democratic Party's Policy Affairs Research Council, often representing the hardline nationalist position advocating abrogation or curtailment of Article 9 of the post-war Japanese Constitution and open remilitarization of the armed forces. That is taking place today. But it's just, to me, it's surreal. Having grown up watching Victory at Sea, programs like that, and when I was a boy growing up watching footage, for example, of the USS Yorktown, the carriers that was sunk in World War II, and in general, watching the brutal reverses of the U.S. Navy and military in the Pacific in the early part of the war, it literally brought tears to my eyes when I was a boy watching this. And it's surreal that the guy who led the Japanese, basically designed and commanded the Japanese air mother to attack Pearl Harbor, killing thousands of Americans, was given the award again. Genda visited Lockheed's headquarters in California and at his own request personally flew a starfighter. He was awarded the Legion of Merit by the United States Air Force a few months later. Well, isn't that terrific? I mean, what could be more patriotic than bombing Pearl Harbor? I mean, sweet, creeping Jesus, this is surreal. Just surreal. And by the way, so is the following. Talking about leaks, the following is from the Wall Street Journal of August 7th of 2013. Echoes from a past leak probe, unquote, by Jess Braven. Newly released documents provide a roadmap of how the government tried to mount a no-holds-barred legal attack against journalists suspected of leaking military secrets. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the executive branch on the extent of its own powers, published in late July a selection of previously secret legal opinions spanning from 1933 to 1977. Among them were memos about a June 7th, 1942 scoop in the Chicago Tribune by correspondent Stanley Johnson, who saw a naval intelligence file while traveling with the Pacific Fleet. Pentagon officials, by the way, it was the Chicago Tribune that was among the papers that published the Rainbow Five mobilization plan for World War II that was leaked to the press on December 5th of 1941 by Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer, part of the MacArthur Group in the military. Continuing. A June 7th, 1942 scoop in the Chicago Tribune by correspondent Stanley Johnson, who saw a naval intelligence file while traveling with the Pacific Fleet. Pentagon officials were stunned by the headline, quote, U.S. Navy knew in advance all about Jap fleet, unquote, when they saw the story, which also ran in the Washington Times Herald. The article all but revealed one of the war's greatest secrets, that the U.S. had cracked the Japanese Navy's code. It reported that Japanese fleet strength, quote, was well known in American naval circles, unquote, but the U.S. Navy knew the Japanese would likely to stage a feint against the Aleutian Islands, unquote. The advance information enabled the American Navy to make full use of air attacks on the approaching Japanese ships. Navy Secretary Frank Knox wrote to Attorney General Francis Biddle demanding indictments. The headline alone discloses, quote, discloses secret and confidential information to the detriment of our national defense, unquote, Mr. Knox wrote. Mr. Biddle then asked staff for advice, resulting in the just released memos. That's Attorney General Francis Biddle. Note the following. The memos are noticeably silent on one possibly pertinent point. The Chicago Tribune's publisher, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, was an incendiary antagonist of the New Deal, and before Pearl Harbor, at least a vociferous opponent of intervention in World War II. Well, that is very interesting indeed. And some interesting speculative elements. One of the things that I find very interesting is that the Operation Golden Lily, the systematic looting of Asia by Japan, began with the rape of Nanking in 1937. I discussed that at considerable length, leaving from the book Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. I will have discussion of that, or excerpts of that, in the written description for this program. But we just don't have time to go into it. One of the things I found very interesting, too, is that one of the things that the Purple Code intercepts permitted was the following, and this is, I think, very, very relevant indeed. Breaking the Japanese codes provided our Navy with incredibly accurate information about when Japanese merchant ships were to sail from port, including their routes and their destinations. It was the key to our successful submarine campaign. We also learned exactly how many ships Japan lost during the course of the war, where they were lost, and when. One of the things that the Seagraves write about in Gold Warriors is that they, because the Japanese, and they also talk about this in the Yamato Dynasty, because when the American submarine blockade kicked into effect, became much more effective, much of the loot, or the considerable amounts of loot were put on board ships, which were then deliberately sunk in shallow waters. And in some cases, obviously, it was sunk by U.S. submarines. I suspect that one of the things that's going on with efforts to, successful efforts to locate U.S. warships sunk in World War II, these submarines, Greyback and Harbor being two of them, the destroyer Edsel, EBSALL, and others, I suspect those efforts are masking, efforts to locate some of the ships that were sunk with lots of gold bullion on them so that they can basically be added to the enormous take that was put together by the Japanese in World War II. And if some of this appears, and by the way, the excerpts about the rape of Nanking being the beginning of Operation Golden Lily on pages 37 through 39 of Gold Warriors that will be in the written description to this program. But you notice we're not hearing about Colonel McCormick publishing secret information. We don't hear about Albert Kobe Wiedemeyer, and by the way, I've discussed that in many programs, leaking the Rainbow Five plan on December 5th of 1941. But again, please note that Admiral Kimmel, and he also notified General Short, he was notified on December 3rd about the fact that the Japanese were burning their code machines. He should have bloody well known. He was notified on November 27th, 1941, that basically war was imminent, and that's why the carriers were ferrying aircraft to Wake Island, that was the Enterprise, and to Midway, that was the Lexington, the Saratoga was in port, but basically routine repairs in San Diego. But when the USS Ward attacked one of the Japanese midget submarines, and again, Kimmel and Short were warned about Japanese submarine attack on January 24th of 1941, when the USS Ward engaged that Japanese midget submarine and sank it and notified Admiral Husband Kimmel of that, Admiral Husband Kimmel, should have put Pearl Harbor on general quarters. That way the Japanese air armada would have been met with vigorous anti-aircraft fire. Their attacks would have been far less effective if that had happened. But he didn't do it, and many, many American servicemen died as a result of that. And that is what really happened at Pearl Harbor. It wasn't deliberately allowed by Franklin Roosevelt, blah, 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 blah. And that conspiracy theory, and that's what it is, boys and girls, that is extant to this day. And the attack on Pearl Harbor. Oh, by the way, I should also mention that Thomas Dewey ran for president again in 1948. As I mentioned earlier, his campaign manager, his official title was Alan Dulles. And the Nazi contingent in the Republican Party, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, a repurposing of the Committee of Subjugated Nations formed by Alfred Rosenberg and Adolf Hitler in 1943. That was some of the fascist collaborationist governments that worked with the Nazis, the OUNB in Ukraine, the direct predecessors of the forces in power there, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, the Bulgarian National Front, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Croatian Ustashi, and others. They were forged into a key element of the Republican Party. That was the godchild of Alan Dulles, so the brainchild of Alan Dulles, who put that together in the immediate aftermath of Dewey's defeat in 1948, which they blame on, quote, the Jews, unquote. The guy he chose to oversee that program was Richard Nixon, first a representative, and Jerry Voorhees, Representative Jerry Voorhees, defeated by Nixon, was leading the congressional fight to break up I.G. Farben, as we spoke about in AFA program number 2. He then defeated Helen Gahagan Douglas. He became a senator, then vice president twice. And President twice, the fellow who was the chief spokesperson for that program was Ronald Reagan, the guy who basically handled the State Department machinations to bring these Nazis into the U.S., was William Casey, appointed by the aforementioned Alan Dulles to oversee secret intelligence in Germany, captured Germany in late 1944, and he presided over this whole bloody mess. And the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council was only put in, they used to only coalesce in presidential election years when it was viewed as being able to deliver the swing vote in 5 key states. It was made a permanent branch of the Republican Party when George H.W. Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee. What we've got there, folks, is Vice President Nixon twice, President Nixon twice, Reagan twice, William Casey, his campaign manager and CIA director, and then George H.W. Bush, who was vice president twice under Reagan, and then president himself. These are the people who dominated the Republican Party. And today, Roosevelt's alleged conspiratorial attempt to allow Pearl Harbor attack to go forward to get America into the war, one of the propaganda tools being used to discredit the New Deal, and the Republicans are looking to unpack, basically to whittle away Social Security, which was FDR's implement. He implemented that. And also Medicare, that was implemented by JFK, and not only Alan Dulles, but also John J. McCoy, who was the assistant to Henry Stimson, and who also, by the way, had access to the magic intercepts. He also was a key member of the Warren Commission, and on November 22nd, 1963, the U.S. experienced a coup d'etat. But again, this is not at all, you know, this old stuff, you know, look at Dave Emery talking about all that old stuff in World War II. It isn't old stuff in World War II, as I have intoned periodically on the weekly talk show that I do. If you don't study history, the world is a mystery. And please get the flash drive of all of my life's work on it. I get no money from that. This concludes, for the record, program number 1363, What Really Happened at Pearl Harbor, Part 2. This is being recorded on December 7th of 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.